Well, thank you very much, Christina, and thanks to Alan and Dave for inviting me here to UBC. Thanks to all of you for coming, and of course, thanks to Larry Grant and the Musqueam people for that beautiful welcome. You know, one of the intense... Can you see that image from the back? Is it kind of obscured? It looks a little murky to me. It's okay? Okay. Thanks. One of the intense pleasures of travel, as I've often said, is the opportunity to live amongst those who have not forgotten the old ways, who still feel their past in the wind, touch it in stones polished by rain, taste it in the bitter leaves of plants. And just to know that in the Amazon, jaguar shamans still journey beyond the Milky Way, or that in the high Arctic, the myths of the Inuit elders still resonate with meaning, or that in the Himalaya, the Buddhists still pursue the breath of the Dharma, is really to remember the central revelation of anthropology, and that is the idea that the world into which you were born does not exist in some absolute sense, but is just one model of reality, the consequence of one particular set of adaptive and intellectual choices that your lineage made, however successfully, many generations ago. But whether it is the Penan in the forests of Borneo, the voodoo acolytes in Haiti, or indeed the yak herders in the slopes of Shomolungma, Everest, the goddess mother of the world, all of these other peoples teach us that there are other ways of being, other ways of thinking, other ways of orienting yourself in space and sacred geography. And that's an idea that, if you think about it, can only fill you with hope. Now, as Christina mentioned, the myriad cultures of the world make up a social and spiritual and intellectual web of life that envelops the planet and is as important to the well-being of the planet as indeed is the biological web of life that you know as a biosphere. And some years ago, when I wrote a book, Light at the Edge of the World, I introduced this term ethnosphere kind of as an organizing principle to encourage people to try to think of culture in new ways. And I sort of define the ethnosphere as being that web of life. You know, the ethnosphere is sort of the sum total of all thoughts and dreams, ideas and myths, intuitions and inspirations brought into being by the human imagination since the dawn of consciousness. The ethnosphere is humanity's great legacy. It's a symbol of all that we've achieved and the promise of all that we can achieve as a wildly creative and imaginative species. And just as the biosphere is being severely impacted with the loss of habitat and the concomitant loss of plant and animal life, so too is the ethnosphere, but if anything, at a far more dramatic rate. No biologist, for example, would dare suggest that 50% of all plants and animals are moribund or on the brink of extinction, because it simply is not true. And yet that, the most apocalyptic scenario in the realm of biological diversity, scarcely approaches what we know to be the most optimistic scenario in the realm of cultural diversity. And the great indicator of this, of course, is language loss. When each of you in this room were born, there were 6,000 languages spoken on Earth. Now, a language isn't just a body of vocabulary or a set of grammatical structures. A language, by definition, is a flash of the human spirit. It's a vehicle, as Larry suggested, through which the soul of every particular culture comes into the material world. Every language is an old-growth forest of the mind, a watershed of thought, an ecosystem of social and spiritual possibilities. And of those 6,000 languages spoken the day that you were born, today fully half are not being taught to children. They're not being whispered into the ears of infants, which means that effectively, unless something changes, they will be dead within a generation. And this is a rather extraordinary statistic. And of course, there are many people who say, well, wait a minute, wouldn't the world be a better place if we all just spoke one language? Wouldn't communication be facilitated? Wouldn't it be easier for us to get along? And my retort to all that is to say, what a great idea. But let's make that language Musqueam. Let's make it Haida. Let's make it Quechua. Let's make it Tibetan. And suddenly you begin to have a sense, as being a native speaker of English, of what it would be like to be enveloped in silence, to have no way to pass on the wisdom of your ancestors or to anticipate the promise of your descendants. And yet that dreadful plight is indeed the plight of somebody somewhere on Earth every fortnight, because on average, every 2 weeks, some elder passes away and carries with them into the grave the last syllables of an ancient tongue. But the question really becomes, what is being lost? What is at risk? And what am I talking about when I speak of the erosion of the ethnosphere? Well, we have a kind of conceit in the West that while we've been indulging technological wizardry, the other peoples of the world have somehow been intellectually idle. Nothing could be further from the truth. Philosophers, or biologists rather, have finally proven it to be true what philosophers always dreamt to be true, and that is the fact that we're all brothers and sisters. We are all, by definition, cut from the same genetic cloth. All human populations share the same raw intellectual capacity, the same mental acuity. And whether that genius is placed into technological innovation and wizardry, as has been the tradition in the West, or by contrast in the homeland of the Dogon, in the deserts of Mali, into unraveling the mystic threads of memory inherent in a myth, is simply a matter of choice and cultural orientation. But what do I mean by different ways of being, different ways of thinking? Well, I recently spent a month in Nepal and Tibet making a film on the Buddhist science of the mind. And why did we use that term, science of the mind? Well, what is science but the empirical pursuit of the truth? And what is the Buddhist path but an attempt to delineate an empirical path to salvation, redemption, and liberation? The Buddhists used to say to me, you know, we don't really believe that you put a man on the moon, but we know that you did. You may not believe that we achieve enlightenment and serenity in one lifetime, but we do. And so, but what do I mean by being, you know, these different cultures making for different capacities of the human potential? Well, if we sweep for a moment into the greatest culture sphere ever brought into being by the human imagination, that of Polynesia, a quarter of the surface of the planet, 10 million square kilometers, tens of thousands of islands flung like jewels upon the sea. And I recently was fortunate to be able to sail on this extraordinary vessel known as a Hokulea, after the sacred star of Hawaii, a reconstruction of the ancient catamarans, these sea-voyaging canoes that carried the Polynesian people across the immense diaspora that spread from Samoa within 1,000 years all the way to Rapa Nui, to Hawaii, and to New Zealand in the southwest. And sailing with these navigators, I wanted to do two things. One, celebrate the brilliance of the navigational techniques themselves. Navigational techniques that were celebrated by James Cook when he first encountered the Polynesians during his seminal voyages in the 18th century. Navigators who today can name and track 250 stars in the night sky. Navigators who can sense the presence of a distant atoll of islands beyond the visible horizon simply by watching the reverberation of waves coming across the hull of the canoe, knowing full well that every atoll of the Pacific has a specific pattern of reverberation that can be read with the same dexterity and perspicacity with which a forensic scientist would read a fingerprint. Navigators who, in the darkness in the hull of the canoes, can distinguish as many as 32 different sea swells moving through the vessel at any one point in time, distinguishing local wind disturbances from local weather patterns, from the deep pulses that originate thousands of miles away in the ocean, currents that can be read like rivers and followed like rivers with the same ease with which a terrestrial explorer would follow a river to the sea. And if you took all of the genius that indeed allowed us to place a man on the moon and applied it to an understanding of the ocean, what you would get is Polynesia. And just this summer, I was able to travel through Melanesia and experience firsthand the continuing tradition of one of the most remarkable economic systems ever brought into being by humanity, and that, of course, is the legendary Kula Ring of the Trobriand Islands. This is a truly marvelous story, and one of the great stories of anthropology. The terrific and legendary anthropologist Malinowski was interned on the Trobriand Islands during World War I. He had come out of the London School of Economics, and at that time in European history, all of economic theory was essentially divided into two schools. The Marxists, who maintained that the creators of goods, the labor force, should control the product of wealth created by that production, or those on the side of capitalism who maintain that it was those who invested in the infrastructure, the production facility, who should control the wealth. But neither school doubted the reality that they maintained that all economics was about the creation of a commodity that was given an inherent value, a value that would be transformed and transferred at the point of exchange, such that the object came into the possession permanently of the individual who had bought it from the previous owner. And suddenly Malinowski comes upon the Kula Ring. And what did he discover in these remote Trobriand islands? He discovered that there were two sacred necklaces of different names, and the necklaces were traded over thousands of miles of open water by young men who went out in these extraordinary canoes into the open oceans with a single mission. One of the sacred shell necklaces would travel in a clockwise direction over thousands of miles of ocean, taking fully 6 years to complete its cycle. The other sacred shell went the opposite direction, similarly traversing the trajectory of the first in the opposite direction, again taking 6 years to complete the journey. The sacred object for which people were prepared to risk their lives, leave their families, face the unknown, was exchanged in great ceremonial gestures by the Kula partners of the sacred ring. But the amazing thing about it is that the minute you gained possession of this object, you also inherited the obligation to pass it on. So you had this extraordinary scenario revealed by the anthropologist Malinowski, where an entire civilization, in a sense, was trading on a completely non-utilitarian object, risking all to pass on an object that that once in one's possession only implied the obligation to continue the sacred cycle of traversing the open ocean. Now, if we move from Melanesia for a moment and the great oceans of the Pacific into the greatest forest sphere on Earth, leaving behind the Hokulea and entering the equatorial forests of the Northwest Amazon, we can see another set of metaphors propelling the lives of the people. People like the Barasana, a people of the Anaconda, who believed that mythologically they came up the Milk River from the east in the belly of the sacred serpent, only to be regurgitated under the various affluents of the Northwest Amazon. A people who live so intimately with their forest homeland that they cognitively do not distinguish the color blue from the color green, because the canopy of the heavens is equated to the canopy of the rainforest. A people who have a curious marriage rule: you must marry someone who speaks a totally different language. And in any one longhouse, you may have six or seven languages spoken, but curiously, you never hear a child practicing a different tongue. They simply watch, wait, listen, and one day begin to speak. Well, if we slip from the homeland of the people of the Anaconda into the homeland of the Warani, we enter the realm of one of the most extraordinary societies in the equatorial belt of South America. The Warani are legendary in part because they were first peacefully contacted in 1958, fully 5 years after I was born. In 1957, five missionaries attempted contact and made a critical mistake. They dropped from the air 8x10 glossy photographs of themselves in what we would say to be friendly gestures, forgetting that these people of the rainforest had never seen anything two-dimensional in their lives. They picked up the photographs from the forest floor, concluded that these were calling cards from the devil when they could not find the form to the face that was a figure on the front of the photograph, and when the missionaries attempted contact, they promptly speared them to death. But the Warani didn't just spear outsiders. We traced genealogies back 8 generations and found out that 54% of their mortality was due to them spearing each other. We found only 2 cases of natural death, and when we kind of pressured the fellas about it, they admitted that one of the guys had gotten so old that he died getting old, so we speared him anyway. But they also had a perspicacious knowledge of the forest that was astonishing. Their hunters could smell animal urine at 40 paces in the rainforest and tell you what form of life had left that behind. And that knowledge and that intuition and that empirical experimentation with the flora of the Amazon had yielded this extraordinary pharmacopoeia. Plants like this one being used by Kuwe, a jaguar shaman, Karari, the flying death, the muscle relaxant that was used as a kind of an adjunct to the hunting technology, a compound that once it entered modern medicine revolutionized abdominal surgery. And the same understanding of the forest that led to the understanding of these curious toxic plants invariably led to an understanding of the psychotropic plants. And my great professor at Harvard used to always say, Richard Evans Schultes, that in going to the field, we should always remember the adage of the Greek scholar Paracelsus, that the difference between a poison, a narcotic, and a medicine was simply dosage. And so we invariably became interested in the discovery of any biodynamic plant, and invariably were drawn into the realm of the shamanic art of healing. To understand what a shaman is and what the teachings are all about, the first thing I suppose you must do is get rid of all kind of ideas you have from all these mail-order mystics like Shirley MacLaine, that these shamans are somehow these benign grandfather figures with feathers and bells. I've been with a lot of shamans. I've never met one that wasn't psychotic. That's their job. They're the ones who swim, as Joseph Campbell said, in the mystic waters the rest of us would drown in. They're the ones who want to enter these realms of the metaphysical when most of us just want to raise our children, feed our children, house our babies. And the shamanic path is not an easy one or a trivial one. I was recently in Ecuador with the Kofan people, and I was able, as I'll describe in a moment, to go through a very interesting ayahuasca ceremony in the sacred men's hut in the depths of the forest. And after literally having my consciousness drip out the sides of my head throughout a very long and rainy night, I turned to these guys in the morning. I said, you know, this stuff really scares the hell out of me. And they said, yeah, me too. And I said, well, wait, what do you mean? And he said, yeah. He said, that's the point. And then the shaman, the curandero, Fernando, took me aside and he said, you know, the point is to enter that realm where the jaguar lives, to see the pelts of the jaguar hanging on the rafters all around you, and not only be able to face the jaguar, but to be able to ultimately put on the skin of the jaguar and become transformed into the creature of the forest. Not an easy task and certainly a daunting task. But, of course, the shamanic art of healing works on two very different levels. In the West, we define disease as a sort of a presence or absence of pathogens or some kind of exogenous force coming into the body. And in these societies, disease is conceived as something that has its origin in a point of disequilibrium, when both the spiritual, social, psychological, and physical components of the individual do not find their proper rest. Therefore, diseases can be treated on two very different levels in most of these societies, in many small indigenous communities throughout the world, in fact. And those two levels are the mundane and the sacred. In other words, diseases can be treated symptomatically, much as we do, only in place of medicinal drugs, they use medicinal plants, many of which are pharmacologically active in the source of our drugs in a modern pharmacy. But critically, that somatic treatment of disease is seen as being somewhat mundane, because to really get to the source of the problem, the cause of the disequilibrium, if you will, the shaman must invoke some technique of ecstasy to soar away on the wings of trance to get into those very mystical and metaphysical realms where he or she can work their deeds of rescue. And this really accounts for why it is that of the 120 hallucinogenic plants that have been discovered by human societies, 90% are found in the Americas. Not because the forests of equatorial West Africa or Southeast Asia are depauperate of biodynamic compounds, quite to the contrary, but rather the use of these plants is firmly rooted in culture. And as I will see in a moment, these peoples of Asia and Africa had other avenues to their gods. In the Americas, the vehicle to the sacred was the arrow of the sacred plant. And that's why you have curious entities like this one, Ebene, used by the Yanomami at the headwaters of the Orinoco River. Ebene is derived from the blood-red resin of several species in the genus Virola in the nutmeg family. It's a powder that, once prepared, is chock full of powerful tryptamines, 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine, dimethyltryptamine, very close to brain serotonin, which is itself a tryptamine. And to have this shot up your nose is rather like being shot out of a rifle barrel lined with Baroque paintings and landing on a sea of electricity. It creates not the distortion of reality, it creates the disillusion of reality. In fact, I used to argue with my Harvard professor Schultes that you couldn't really classify this as hallucinogenic, because by the time you were under its influence, there was no one home anymore to experience the hallucinations. But the thing that draws us to the study of these plants is not simply their dazzling pharmacological aspects, but what they tell us about a different way of knowing. This is my friend Fernando, a curandero of great renown from amongst the Kofan people. This is a photograph taken last June in the wake, in the dawn light, at the end of this nocturnal ceremony. I'm 195 pounds. I had taken one calabash of ayahuasca, and it had left me prostrate before the gates of awe in my hammock. This man of 120 pounds had taken six calabashes of the sacred substance, and he still clearly, in this photograph, is in a realm beyond this one. And what fascinates about us about ayahuasca, which is the most important preparation of the shaman's repertoire in the Northwest Amazon, is what it tells us about the empirical experimentation that has gone on in the Amazon, presumably for generations. Ayahuasca is a combination of plants, and just to put this photograph of another friend of mine in to emphasize this idea of Paracelsus, the same kind of dexterity with which the people manipulate the psychoactive plants also leads to the elaboration of these toxic plants. This again is a form of curare, but the curare used by the Kofan is remarkable in the sense that they were the great poison makers of the Amazon, and we now know that they had trading routes that spread over literally hundreds of miles in the Amazon, where they would bring various admixture plants in to create these powerful combinations that were the foundation of the toxicity of their venoms. But that same kind of manipulation of plants, of course, lies at the foundation of this curious potion, ayahuasca, the vision vine, the vine of the soul. It is, on the one hand, a woody liana found in the forest, pounded so that the outer bark, which contains these high concentration of tannins, can be removed. The inner bark is then boiled over the course of a very long day, always within this marvelous balance of the sacred and the secular, the sort of metaphysical and the mundane, in the hut prepared for the ceremony over the course of a long day of gossip and and conversation as the actual brew is prepared. Now, to the preparation, then, are added the leaves of a nondescript shrub in the coffee family called Psychotria viridis. Now, this shrub is full of tryptamines, but tryptamines are orally inactive. That's why the Yanomami have learned to blow them up their noses, because they're orally inactive because tryptamines, which means that they can't be taken through the mouth, because they're denatured by an enzyme found naturally in the human stomach, monoamine oxidase. They can only be taken orally if taken in conjunction with some other compound that momentarily denatures the MAO found in the human stomach. It turns out that the beta-carbolines found in the woody liana, Banisteriopsis caapi, are MAO inhibitors of the precise sort necessary to potentiate the tryptamines in the leaves of the rubiaceous plant. But here's where you have to ask the question: how in a flora of 80,000 species of vascular plants did the First Nations of the Amazon learn to find these morphologically distinct denizens of the rainforest and combine them in this remarkable way to create a kind of biochemical version of the whole being greater than the sum of the parts? The only scientific explanation in the Western sense is trial and error, which is quickly exposed as being statistically a meaningless euphemism. You ask the Indians, and they tell you, the plants teach us. And when you inquire further, they look at you like you're an idiot who clearly knows nothing. And what they mean when they say the plants teach us, the Kofan and the Siona Sequoia were reported in the 1940s by my professor to have 17 different varieties of this woody liana, all of which were referable to his taxonomic eye as being a single species. And yet his informants and colleagues constantly recognized and distinguished the 17 varieties in the forest and sometimes at great distances in the forest. And when he finally asked them, what is the nature of your systematics, your classification system, they looked at him like he was clearly an idiot, and they said, well, you know nothing. And it turned out the way they distinguished their 17 different varieties was that you took each one on the night of a full moon, and each different one sang to you in a different key. Now, that's not going to get you a PhD in botany at UBC, but it's a hell of a lot more interesting than counting flower parts. But it raises the issue of a different way of knowing. And now we know from the Kofan that, for example, there is an ongoing, dynamic, constant process of experimentation. While I was down there, I ran into a fellow who had just come back from the forest experimenting with powerful emetic plants taken in a really horrendous ritual manner, all with the idea of increasing the musculature around the diaphragm so that he would be more efficacious and have a stronger breath to use when he was shooting the blowgun. So what we see throughout the Amazon is, on the one hand, an empirical experimentation that is as sophisticated as that of a Western-trained scientist, combined with a kind of intuition unshackled by the constraints of Descartesian logic that allows for a kind of almost metaphysical understanding of a place that they know so well. And that, I think, is a lesson that carries us further. And indeed, if we follow the metaphor of botany from the Amazon lowlands of Ecuador up toward the height of the Andes, the Andean Cordillera that runs like a spine across the western side of South America, and enter the homeland of the Incan people. This is a photograph taken at the very headwaters of the Rio Apurimac, the Lord Oracle River, and if we then move higher up into the Andes, we will enter the sacred sites of the Inca people. I was very fortunate in meeting that Professor Schultes at Harvard. I gave a lecture in Victoria last night about him, and I mentioned a number of things. One of the things fascinating about him is he was the man who sparked the psychedelic era with his discovery of the so-called magic mushrooms in Mexico in 1938. But he was so conservative that he didn't vote for the Republican Party, although he probably would have done so yesterday, perhaps. I don't think so. But he professed not to believe in the American Revolution. He always voted for Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II. He wouldn't use a Kennedy stamp. One colleague of his said the only way for Schultes, who spent 13 years in the Amazon, to go native would be to go to London. And knowing nothing of this history, I knocked at his door at the age of 19 and got as far as saying, "Sir, I'm from British." And that's all it took, that adjective. "I'm from British Columbia. I've saved up money in a logging camp, and I want to go to the Amazon like you did." Now, I think at many Canadian universities, you might have been asked for what courses you've taken, where did your money really come from, you know, what are you studying, whatever, who are you? This wonderful man who was known as the father of ethnobotany, a man for whom mountains had been named in South America, just peered across a mound of plant specimens through his antiquated bifocals and said very simply to me, "Well, son, when do you want to go?" And 2 weeks later, I was in the Amazon. And just before leaving, I dropped by his office for some advice, and his key advice that was to placate my mother at home in Victoria was that I was not to come back from South America without trying ayahuasca, the vision vine, the most powerful of these plants. But he also said to me, "You should look up my man in Colombia, his protege, the great botanist, the late Timothy Plowman." And Schultes had done for Timothy the impossible. He had secured the Dream Academic Grant of the 1970s, $250,000 from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to study a plant known to the Inca as a divine leaf of immortality, coca, the notorious source of cocaine. And it was an extraordinary assignment because the efforts to eradicate the traditional fields had been underway for over 50 years, long before there was a cocaine problem in the streets of American and European cities. The effort to eradicate those traditional fields, incidentally, never had anything to do with the pharmacology of cocaine hydrochloride and everything to do with the cultural identity of those Andean peoples who chose to revere the plant. But even though this was a plant that had yielded a drug that was a most important topical anesthetic in the modern materia medica, cocaine, which had allowed for, particularly in ophthalmology, the painless removal of cataracts, a vitally important drug when used in proper context, amazing little was known about it. Nobody knew how many species yielded the drug. Nobody knew its point of origin. Nobody critically had ever done a nutritional study of the plant, even though it was consumed every day by millions of South American Indians. We knew that today and in the past, the plant was revered as no other. We knew that no field could be harvested or planted, no child brought into the realm of the living, no elder led into the realm of the dead, without some kind of reciprocal relationship, without some kind of reciprocal exchange between the people and the earth itself, Pachamama. We knew that coca was given at all moments of transition in the society. We knew that during the time of the Inca, you couldn't appear at any holy shrine if you did not have coke in your mouth. And indeed, the Inca, unable to cultivate the plant at the elevation of the imperial capital of Cusco, had replicated it in gold and silver leaf and fields that colored the landscape. And one of the things we did do together, Tim and I, and some other colleagues, is we did the first nutritional study of the plant. And what we found absolutely horrified our backers of the U.S. government. We found out that, yes, it had a small amount of cocaine in it, half to 1% dry weight, roughly the amount of caffeine in a coffee bean, and nobody noticed the irony that at every drug abuse conference, every DEA agent and narc bolted for the coffee pot at 10 o'clock in the morning. But to compare the plant with cocaine hydrochloride was as inappropriate as comparing the luscious fruit of a peach with the toxic prussic acid found in the pit of a peach. We also showed that the plant was chock full of vitamins. It had more calcium in it than any plant that had ever been studied by the U.S. government, which made it perfect for a diet that lacked a dairy product. We also found that it had enzymes that enhance the body's ability to digest carbohydrate at high elevation, which made it perfect for the traditional diet of the Andes. So in one kind of elegant scientific assay, Timothy put into stark profile the draconian efforts that are underway to this day to eradicate the traditional fields, and we showed that this was a plant that had been used with no evidence of toxicity, let alone addiction, for over 4,000 years in the Andes. Now, in the course of doing this research, I think I first had the intuition of this thought that different cultural beliefs result in different human beings. Whenever we try to understand the relationship between other peoples and landscape, particularly for those of us from the West who have a somewhat truncated relationship with landscape, we always either invoke the old canard of Rousseau and the noble savage, or we turn to Thoreau for inspiration and suggest that some of the native people are more contemplative than we are. Well, you know, these are ideas that are almost racist in their simplicity. Indigenous people all around the world are just human beings. We're all indigenous to the planet. And indeed, there is no place for sentimentality or nostalgia in the lives of most people struggling to find a way to survive in the harsh winds of Tibet or in the chill of the high Arctic. But many cultures have, unlike ourselves, forged a kind of traditional mystique of the earth that is based not on a sort of self-conscious sense of relationship to it, but on a much more subtle intuition. And that is the idea that the earth only exists because it is filtered through the human imagination. I often say that, you know, I was raised in the forest on Vancouver Island to believe that those forests existed to be cut. That was the foundation of the ideology of scientific forestry that I studied here at UBC and that I practice as a logger for McMillan Bloedel. That made me very different from a person from Malcolm Island, a native person of the Quail, who believed that those forests were the abode of Hukuk and the crooked beak of heaven and the cannibal spirits that dwelt at the north end of the world, spirits that would be embraced during the Hamut's initiation such that the wisdom could be brought back to the community in the collective potlatch. Is that forest the domain of the spirits, or is it a repository of cellulose? Again, that's not the interesting question. The interesting observation is how the belief system changes the relationship of each respective society to that resource with clear and significant consequences in terms of the ecological footprint of each particular culture. In the Andes, a kid is raised to believe that an apu hovers over every community, a sacred mountain deity that will direct his or her destiny. That has to make that child a different child with a different relationship to landscape than a kid in British Columbia raised to believe that a mountain is a pile of rock just waiting to be mined. And no place did this sort of intuition come more powerfully to me than the first really highland people I ever lived with. And these, of course, were the legendary Ika, Kohi, and Wiwa, the descendants of the ancient Tairona civilization, which carpeted the Caribbean coastal plain before the time of Columbus. In the wake of the contact, these truly became the survivors of El Dorado in the sense that they retreated to an isolated volcanic massif that soars above the Caribbean coastal plain to 20,000 feet. And to this day, in a bloodstained continent, they alone were never fully conquered by the Spanish, and they remain ruled by a ritual priesthood. The training for the priesthood is astonishing. The ideal period of isolation is 18 years. The young child taken away from the family willingly with the cooperation of the community, sequestered in a sacred hut in a shadowy world of darkness for 2 9-year periods, deliberately chosen to mimic the 9 months of gestation they have spent in their natural mother's womb. Now they are metaphorically in the womb of the Great Mother. And for that entire time, the world only exists as an abstraction, as they are taught the values of their society, values that maintain the idea that their prayers and their prayers alone maintain the cosmic or the ecological balance. They call themselves the Elder Brothers and dismiss the rest of us who lap at the base of their mountain homeland as the younger brothers who have ruined the world. Now, this idea of landscape-inspiring character is something that writers have often pondered, and I always find myself seeking rituals that will reinforce this kind of poetics of relationship to the natural world. And I've spent a great deal of time since the mid-70s, in a community outside of Cusco called Chinchero, a stunningly beautiful highland community, site of the summer palace of Topa Inca Yupanqui, the second of the great Incan rulers. And Chinchero is dominated by a sacred mountain called Antaquilca. And once each year, there is a fantastic ritual called the Mojimiento, which I always wanted to participate in. And it was not until I was 48, just a few years ago, that I found the time and the opportunity to do so. What happens is that once each year, the fastest young boy in each hamlet is honored with the opportunity to become a transvestite. He's known as a huaylaca for one day, and for one day he wears the clothing of his mother or of his sisters. And he carries the banners of the community, leading all able-bodied men on a run. But it's not your ordinary run. You start off at 11,500 feet, and you run 3,000 feet to the base of the sacred mountain Antaquilca. Then you run up to 15,000 feet, only to fall away 3,000 feet on the other side, only to climb an equal distance to a series of high passes, and 24 hours like this of constant running through the light, through the darkness, through the rain, through the sun. The perimeter of the race is marked by holy mounds of earth, sacred points in landscape where the huaylaca must spin, dance, bringing the vortex of the feminine to the mountaintop, giving libations of alcohol to the wind, passing coca onto the flank of Pachamama. And the astonishing metaphor is that, of course, what they are running are the boundaries of the community lands, and the idea being that once each year, through pure exhaustion, through sacrifice, remembering that the word sacrifice means from Latin to make sacred, the men have emerged as a single body, a single pulse that has once again reaffirmed their sense of belonging, their sense of place in that community. Now, that idea of movement through sacred geography becomes more elaborate at the great Pan-Andean pilgrimages such as the Coyariti. And just last June, I was there to make a film about the Coyariti, and it's truly one of the most extraordinary things I've ever witnessed. Just at the time of Corpus Christi, men and women from villages all over the southern Andes, and this great fluorescence of Pan-Andean life that has emerged in the wake of the conquest, who have designed their costumes all year long, merge on the sacred valley of the Sinicara. And they walk about 12 kilometers at the end of a dirt road in a fantastic procession, 30 to 40,000 people from all over the Andes, overseen by these sort of sacred figures that are half human, half animal, images of the beyond. And of course, the women dance 24 hours a day for 3 days straight. Men and women dancing, singing, praying. There is no alcohol allowed, rigidly enforced protocols, and all a great celebration of the sacred. And the sacred is embodied in a series of glaciers that come down off the flank of the mountain in the shadow of this mountain here, Ausangati, the most sacred mountain of the Inca, the Apu of Tehuantzuyu, the four quarters of the world. What happens is that the crosses that are found in the villages are brought up to the mountain, the crosses that, of course, are a symbol of the syncretic fusion of Christianity and pre-Columbian Andean beliefs. The crosses are then carried up onto the ice fields where these fantastic dances and rituals occur, and the crosses are firmly planted in the ice. Ice in Incan cosmology being the miasma of life and death, the crystallization of all human potential. And then, having spent the night in the ice, the crosses, now empowered, are carried back down to the church and beyond to the community along with chunks of ice that are brought back to small villages throughout the Andes. Ice that has now been empowered to become a kind of solidified sacred essence of Ausangati. Now, those Pan-Andean rituals provide us with a clue for even beginning to deconstruct some of the most iconic sites of the Incan Empire. And the Incan Empire was never more than 100 years old. It began in 1438 with the great victory of Pachacuti, and it died in 1534 with the arrival of Pizarro. And if we look at a site like Machu Picchu that Hiram Bingham famously described as a lost city when he stumbled upon it in 1911, Machu Picchu was never lost, yet save in his own imagination. A simple cursory glance at Machu Picchu reveals the network of royal roads that ran away from the site, bifurcating into the network of 22,000 kilometers of royal roads that the Inca spread over the Andean Cordillera in less than a century of its existence as an empire. Machu Picchu itself is set on a spur overlooking the Urubamba River. It is strategically located to control access to the eastern quarter of the empire, Antisuyo, to control access to the heart of the empire, the upper Urubamba and the Sacred Valley. This provided the Inca with an access point to the lowlands, source of coca, medicinal plants, shamanic inspiration, even as it guarded the approaches to the heart of the empire. The site was clearly built with a single architectural plan. Hydrology alone indicates that this was a single conception of the great emperor Pachacuti. Now, that's the easy stuff to see, but let's begin to deconstruct Machu Picchu a little bit further. This is the axis mundi of the site, the sacred center, what Bingham called the hitching post of the sun, a meaningless term for a stone that the Inca called the Intihuatana. But what was this abstract piece of rock? Well, if you look carefully, the iconic sugar loaf that looms over the site of Machu Picchu is known as Huayna Picchu. If you watch the light fall on the face of the Intihuatana, you suddenly discover it is a constant and perfect mimic of exactly what is going on the face of the sacred mountain of Huayna Picchu. If you come to the south of the Intihuatana, you find this altar. If you climb Huayna Picchu, you'll find its sister altar at the top of the mountain. Now, if you take a bearing, a perfect north-south bearing, or in this case, north-south bearing, that bearing goes directly through the Intihuatana stone and then bisects the second most important apu of the empire, Salkantay, which is just in the clouds beyond the hills on the skyline here. Now, at the time of the Southern Cross, at its most southern point in the sky, enmeshed in the Milky Way, which was incredibly important as a source of constellations for the Inca, the Southern Cross lies directly over Salkantay. So the entire site was a cosmological model of the universe. And indeed, if we then turn our eyes downward, we'll see that the water that comes through the site, both literally and metaphorically, comes from the sacred mountain of Salkantay. But then it flows down into the Urubamba River, which, like the arms of a serpent, spread around the site itself. Now, the Urubamba is the earthly equivalent in Incan cosmology to the Milky Way, but it's also the route that Viracocha walked at the dawn of time when he brought the empire into existence. But the Urubamba is born where? On the flanks of Ausangati, at the site of the Coyairiti. So what we see in that great festival of the ice to this day in the Andes of Peru is a reflection of ancient Andean cosmological ideas that bound together the greatest empire that ever was born in the Americas. And so when we realize the power of sacred mountains, we can begin to ask the obvious. The Inca worshipped mountains, they had altars, they had human sacrifice. Let's go up and have a look. which is exactly what my colleague Johann Reinhard did at the National Geographic. He climbed over 150 peaks of over 5,000 meters doing high-altitude archaeology in the freezing cold conditions of the summits of these mountains. And this is how he discovered these perfectly preserved frozen Incan mummies, human sacrifices, young girls who had brought to the edge of death to give life to their communities, to bring literally fertility to the slopes. So if we leave the Americas for a minute and we enter the realm of Africa, you know, I always did whatever Schultes, the professor, asked me to do. And having worked for years in South America, he suddenly one day summoned me to his fourth floor eyrie at the Botanical Museum and asked me very casually if I was interested in going down to Haiti, infiltrating the secret societies, securing the formula of a folk poison said to be used to make zombies. Well, naturally, I said yes. And thinking that this was some kind of lark, a kind of paid vacation in the middle of a miserable Boston winter, I went down thinking that it would consume a fortnight of my life. It ended up consuming 4 years of my life. Because the first thing I had to ask when I went to Haiti was, what was the origin of my own misconceptions about this remarkable religion of voodoo? Voodoo is not a black magic cult, quite to the contrary. It's simply the distillation of very profound religious ideas that came over during the tragic diaspora of the slavery era and became sown in the fertile soil of the New World. You know, if I asked you to name the great religions of the world, what would you say? Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, whatever, Judaism. There's always one continent left out, sub-Saharan Africa, the tacit assumption being that African people had no religion. Well, of course, by definition, they did, and voodoo is simply the essence of that set of religious beliefs. And the essence of the religion is an idea that the dead wield power in the realm of the living give birth to the dead in turn become the spirits of the pantheon, the spirits that are seen as the multiple manifestations of a greater God, spirits that in this quintessentially democratic faith must be made to serve the living. To serve the living, they must become manifest. To become manifest, they must respond to the rhythm of the drums, the power of the song, to come back from the realm of the great waters, from below the realm of the invisibles, to momentarily displace the soul of the living, so that for that brief shining moment, the human being actually becomes the God. And that is why African people in sacred contexts move in and out of their spirit realm with an ease and impunity that's always astonished the ethnographic observer. The Haitians used to say to me, "You white people go to church and speak about God. We dance in the temple and become God." And spirit possession is not some kind of pathological moment. It is for the African people a state of divine grace in which human being and spirit become one and the same. And it is, of course, an expression in public and private of the profundity of the faith in which these people hold their gods to be real. And, of course, when you are possessed by a god, how can you be harmed? Because you're a god. And thus you see these marvelous theatrical shows of faith and power. In this case, in Benin, before the fetish symbol, a man in the Koko ritual cutting into the bicep with a blade. Or more profoundly, perhaps, in Haiti, voodoo acolytes in a state of trance, handling burning embers with impunity. A kind of an amazing example of the mind's ability to affect the body that bears it when catalyzed in a state of extreme excitation. And I think it was Haiti that really taught me that this great lesson of anthropology, that different cultural beliefs can make for different human beings. Because in 4 years in South America, I never had available to me what was made available to me within 48 hours of arriving in Haiti. And that was truly a window wide open to the mystic. Voodoo is not a black magic cult. It's a complex, beautiful, quintessentially democratic faith. Now, so I hope that gives you some sense of the beauty and the wonder of what I've called the ethnosphere, but the tragedy now becomes what is happening to the ethnosphere. This century will not be remembered for its wars or its technological innovations 100 years hence, I don't think, as much as for as being the era in which we stood by and either actively endorsed or passively accepted the massive destruction of cultural diversity and biological diversity in the planet. And I want to stress that the problem is not change. All peoples through all time have constantly been dancing with new opportunities for life. Nor is the problem technology. The Lakota did not stop being Lakota when they gave up the bow and arrow in favor of the rifle any more than an American farmer stopped being an American when they gave up the horse and buggy in favor of the automobile. It is neither change nor technology that threatens the integrity of culture. It is power, the crude face of domination. We have this kind of conceit that these peoples, quaint and colorful as they may be on the margins of the world, are somehow destined to fade away as if by some natural law, as if they're failed attempts at being us, failed attempts at being modern. Nothing could be further from the truth. In every instance, these are dynamic living peoples being driven out of existence by identifiable forces and beyond their capacity to resist. And that actually is an optimistic observation because it suggests that if human beings are the agents of cultural destruction, we can be the facilitators of cultural survival. And the forces of negativity are myriad. In the homeland of the people of the sacred canoe, the Winikina Warao of the Orinoco Delta, from there to the headwaters of the Orinoco and the homeland of the Yanomami, we still see diseases sweeping into isolated populations and not decimating those populations, but in some cases killing as many as 90% of the societies, a figure that is comparable to what happened at the time of contact when it wasn't 10% of the Amerindian peoples that were swept away or 10% of the Polynesians, but fully 90% of these populations were destroyed by their lack of resistance to exogenous diseases brought in by the Europeans. And the Marquesas in Polynesia, in the Marquesan language, the word for sailor is the same word as the word for venereal disease. And when I worked on Haiti and Haitian voodoo, I wrote a book called The Serpent and the Rainbow that was made into probably the worst Hollywood movie in history. And Hemingway said that if you sell a book to Hollywood, you should start off in Arizona, drive to the California state line, throw your book over, and go back to Tucson and have a good drink. I didn't do that. I disappeared through the help of a close friend of mine, Tom Henley, another friend, Ian McKenzie, both from BC, into the forest of the Penan in Sarawak in Southeast Asia. I always wanted to experience a land wet with the innocence of birth. I always wanted to live, or at least experience life, with the nomadic people of the rainforest. Why? Because we were all once nomads, wanderers on a pristine planet. The Neolithic revolution that gave us agriculture and yielded surplus, hierarchy, specialization. As Joseph Campbell said, the transformation of the human Borneo, East Malaysian state of Sarawak into the South China Sea. And those rivers were traditionally the domain of the notorious Dayak headhunters of Borneo, individuals who could not marry if they did not present the severed head of an enemy to a prospective father-in-law. Too often those heads were Penan, and so the Penan fled deep into the forest where they became totally dependent on the material productivity of that forest itself. And I find nomadic society so inherently interesting because, of course, think about it. What is the measure of wealth in a society in which there really are no specialists and in which everything can be made from the forest and in which everything periodically must be carried on your back to the next encampment? There is absolutely no incentive. Indeed, there's a very strong disincentive to acquire material possessions. So what is the measure of wealth in such a place? They explicitly define wealth as a strength of the social relationships between human beings, because if those relationships fray, everybody may suffer. By the same token, in a nomadic society, as in this wonderful photograph taken by my friend Ian McKenzie, sharing becomes an involuntary reflex because you never know who will be the next to bring food to the encampment. I once was with Ian. We watched as a Penan woman took a cigarette that I had given her and tore it apart to distribute equitably the individual strands of tobacco from the cigarette to all women of the encampment, rendering the object useless, but honoring her obligation to share. And we went, all of us, to Sarawak hoping to help the Penan, because in a mere generation, a people for whom the sounds of the forest had inspired their lives were deeply under threat. You know, it's interesting, we forget that most societies are non-literate. They live in a realm of the oral. And in these societies, the entire richness of the language is encoded in the vocabulary of the best storyteller. And because they don't have the shorthand technique of writing, memory becomes extraordinary, and intuitions about the natural world become extraordinary. And I think this is something I've seen amongst Athabascan people, Inuit people, and certainly the Penan and others of the forest, is that in the same way that when we read a novel, a Victorian novel, we can hear on our minds the voices of the characters. By the same token, I find that people like the Penan can hear in nature the sound and the voices of the animals. And so the flight of a hornbill becomes like a cursive script, a vocabulary written on the wind. But sadly, the sounds of the forest, by the time that we reached there in the late 80s, had become the sound of machinery. In the 80s, you heard so much about the demise of the Amazonian rainforest, but recall that the Amazon is the size of the continental United States, the size of the face of the full moon. It's an immense place. In 1985, Brazil produced only 1.3% of the tropical log exports of the world. Roughly 43 to 45% came from Malaysia, much of it from the East Malaysian state of Sarawak, much of it from the homeland of the Penan. So suddenly in a generation, men, women, and children raised in the forest found themselves in a forest that had been torn from beneath them. A forest torn so suddenly that women were forced to find work as prostitutes and servants in these logging camps. It seemed to put so much silt into the rivers of Borneo that it seemed that half of Borneo was slipping away to the South China Sea, where the Japanese freighters hung light on the horizon, ready to fill their holes with raw logs ripped from the heart of the forest. Children finding themselves living in forced settlements, suffering from diseases not known in the natural state in the forest. Women trying to understand what had happened to their lives, as did their husbands, as the world had turned over, and yet the resistance began. And what began as a kind of quixotic gesture, blowpipes against bulldozers, sparked a movement across all of Sarawak that for a time shut down the industry. But of course, these individuals were no match for the power of the Malaysian state. And when I went back in 1998 on assignment for the National Geographic with Ian McKenzie, we found to our astonishment that the number of nomadic families in the forest had been severely reduced to perhaps 50 still living in the forest as their ancestors had done for generations. And so in a single generation, we saw that a people who had been morally inspired with a different vision of life itself, with an understanding of that forest that would put any Harvard scientist to shame, had suddenly found themselves swept away in the same way that the forest had been swept from beneath the foundation of their lives. And just to stress that we don't have to go to the remote reaches of the world to see the same kind of egregious industrial initiatives. Here's a wonderful photograph by my friend Graham Osborne here in British Columbia to remind us that in living in these salmon forests, we suffer from some of the same issues. This is a photograph I took of a Tahltan grandmother, a friend of mine, Lily, who was arrested recently, just a month ago, for participating in a blockade on a road that runs past our fishing lodge in the Stikine of northern British Columbia, Tahltan country. It is now under siege by mineral exploration of extraordinary intensity. And in fact, there is a sadness in me, the extent to which people who live in British Columbia are so unaware of the hinterland of our own province. You know, people refer to Prince George as being northern British Columbia when it's central British Columbia. And in one of the marvelous accidents of geography, four of our most important rivers in British Columbia, the Nass, the Skeena, the Stikine, and the Finley, which is itself the headwaters of the Mackenzie, are all born within 20 to 30 kilometers of each other in a rugged knot of mountains that we call the Sacred Headwaters. It is an astonishingly beautiful place where the rivers are born, where the forests are free, where the landscape is of a character and a power that almost defies imaginings. I recently, I wrote an article for the National Geographic magazine about the Stikine, a valley the size of Switzerland. And if you think of the rivers of British Columbia, it goes the Fraser, the Nass, the Skeena, the Stikine, the Taku, the Tachishini, south to north. And in this article, I tried to put the wonder of the Stikine in context for an American audience. And I found out that in the lower 48, the farthest you can get away from a maintained road is 20 miles. In the northwest quadrant of British Columbia, an area the size of Oregon, there's one road, the Stewart-Cassiar Highway. I tried to put in perspective our greatest canyon, the Grand Canyon of Stikine. I just came back from making an IMAX film, a 3D film in the Grand Canyon of the Colorado with Bobby Kennedy Jr. And, you know, the Grand Canyon, glorious as it is, has 29,000 people go through it every year, and its flow is controlled by a technician. Our greatest canyon in Canada has only had 23 people get through it in all of history, and no raft has ever made it. It's a kind of country, the Stikine, where you could throw England, and the English would never find it. And yet, and for me, this is a very profoundly personal story, because this is my home. This is where I grew up. This is where I began my life as a park ranger when I worked as a hunting guide. I had a marvelous job as the first park ranger in Spatsizi, and the job description was marvelous: public relations and wilderness assessment. In 2 4-month seasons in the mid-70s, my partner and I saw about 7 people. There was no one to relate publicly to. And then, of course, this is also the place where my children have been raised. And this is a place where my relationship with this old man, Alec Jack Atahena, he who walks leaving no tracks, an extraordinary Gitxaun elder who taught me everything I know about this, the valley, a man who shared with me mythology of his people for over 30 years, a man who will be the subject of a book of mine in a few years called Sheets of Distant Rain. But we have, from this lake of Yalui, formed friendships with the Tahltan people of the entire drainage that go back now for almost 30 years. And we have come together with them because within 5 kilometers of this photograph, the Chinese government, the largest copper company in China, which is owned by the Chinese government, has just bought the rights to the BC Metals Red Chris deposit and are proceeding to attempt to put in an open pit copper and gold mine in the flank of a mountain, Tottigan Mountain, that has the highest population of stone sheep in the world. And beyond the end of this lake lie the sacred headwaters. Shell is talking about doing coal bed methane exploration there. Fortune Metals is talking about developing the greatest anthracite mine in the world there. And all of this is occurring at a place that is the headwaters of the rivers that are the salmon rivers of British Columbia, the rivers, the Nass, the sacred to the Nishka, the Skeena, sacred to the Gitxaun Wet'suwet'en and Carrier, the Stikine, sacred to the Tahltan, and the Tlingit at the mouth. And all the peoples from around there are affected by this idea. And I thought about it, you know, I mean, I've been in Tibet a great deal, and many of you probably have been to Kailash, the sacred mountain of the Tibetans, of the Jains, of the Hindus, a mountain that in its flanks give rise to 3 of the greatest rivers of Asia, rivers that give life to over 1 billion human beings. It is inconceivable that the Chinese or the Tibetans or the Indians or the Nepalese would put industrial infrastructure on the flank of that mountain. You're not even allowed to step on that mountain. No climber has ever been allowed to summit Kailash. And the idea of violating that with this kind of intensity of industrial development would be absolutely anathema to the people there. But without a word, with virtually without a whisper, the companies in the Canadian North are now proposing to enter into the sacred headwaters and violate it beyond recognition for all time. Of course, this has not been accepted by the Tahltan people. This is a marvelous photograph taken at a blockade they have set up and maintained for almost a year now. And the reason I say it's a marvelous photograph is because last summer there was a lot of conflict within the community because everybody wanted to maintain the blockade, but it was also the time when the salmon were running. And nobody wanted to miss the fishery, but people wanted to stay on the blockade. And then one of those marvelous things happened. A double tandem trailer coming down from Alaska happened to roll over right at the site of the blockade and happened to be full of Alaskan spring salmon. And so instead of going fishing, cosmically the fish came to the blockaders. And suddenly the forest all around the encampment was decorated with a beautiful fish. And this was an amazing event that happened last summer when chiefs from all the First Nations, Sekani, Kaskadeni, Taku River Tlingit, Gujau came over from the Haida, Gitxaun, Wet'suwet'en, Carrier, and of course Tahltan, and came together at the sacred headwaters at the hunting camp of the late Robert Kwok and took waters from their rivers, and the elders came forward and poured the waters into a cedar-bent box that had been carved by a friend of mine, Huey Carlick, and then the prayers occurred, and then everybody went forward and brought water out of that box to return to their own sacred rivers as a gesture of solidarity. And this is a wonderful photograph of a friend of mine's father, Jimmy Dennis, signing the document at the blockade site, as indeed the widow of Robert Kwok, saying, "Simply no more, they will not pass." And these extraordinarily brave individuals remain on those blockades, and I would really encourage you to pay attention to what is going on in the Stikine. Now, having given you that sort of personal advertisement for a cause very important to me, I want to slip back into the realm of other spaces. If industrial intrusions are a source of problems for indigenous peoples around the world, so too can be ideology. This is a nun that I encountered at Angkor Wat, who you can see has had her feet and her hands severed from her body during the era of Pol Pot for the crime of practicing her religious faith. And if we move from Cambodia into the realm of Tibet, we can really see the power of ideology imposed by a more powerful force. Tibet, of course, is not the cosmic meritocracy of New Age lore, but it is nevertheless, by any ethnographic, any linguistic, any cultural, any historical definition, a world of its own, sitting astride the mountain massif of Central Asia. Tibet, of course, has been under control of the Chinese since 1959. And when His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama first met and attempted mediation with Mao Zedong, the individual who has a dubious distinction as having been able to murder in one lifetime more of his own people than even Hitler and Stalin put together, when Mao Zedong famously whispered into the ears of His Holiness that all religion was poison, His Holiness knew what was coming. When finally the Chinese took over Tibet in 1959, estimates are as high as 1.2 million Tibetans killed for their religious faith. Estimates of 6,000 religious structures torn apart brick by brick, reduced by ash, bombarded from the air, torn apart and torn asunder. You know, how would we feel if the Americans came into Canada and declared all our religious beliefs to be anathema and proceeded with their military strength to tear apart all of our synagogues, all of our churches, all of our temples? Well, this is what in fact happened to the Buddhists. And yet still, the Buddhists remain strong. The pursuit of the Dharma is extraordinary. And I recently came back from making a film on the Buddhist science of the mind. And it was a remarkable opportunity to travel in Tibet with this amazing man, Mathieu Ricard, His Holiness's translator in France. And Mathieu's lineage is extraordinary. His father was one of the greatest French philosophers who famously wrote a two-volume history of Western philosophy simply from memory. In the home that Mathieu grew up in, his people that would come through there would be Cartier-Bresson, Stravinsky, Charles de Gaulle. And he noticed as a young boy this strange correlation, that there was no correlation between fame and achievement and happiness. He himself became a famous molecular biologist, was destined for a pathway that could have led to the Nobel Prize when he dropped everything and went to Tibet in the late 1960s and became ordained as a Tibetan monk. And it was Mathieu who said to me this marvelous line that Western science is a marvelous and a major response to minor needs. We spend all of our lives trying to live to be 100 without losing our teeth and losing our hair. And in Tibet, people spend all of their time trying to understand the nature of existence. He said, "Your billboards in the West advertise naked children in underwear. Our billboards are prayers for the well-being of all sentient beings." He said that, you know, that wonderful line about Tibetans may not believe that you went to the moon, but you did. You may not believe we achieve enlightenment in one lifetime, but we do. And when we went to make these films in this series, Light at the Edge of the World, we always were wanting to have a kind of a conduit to culture from both the outside and the inside. And if Mathieu was our facilitator from the outside looking in, our view from the inside looking out was this Tibetan Amshi doctor, Sherab Barma, who had been trained in 7 arduous years the principles of Tibetan medicine. Or also, because of these two individuals and other colleagues in Kathmandu, we had remarkable access to this extraordinary Lama, Trusig Rinpoche, the head of the Nyingma tradition, a teacher of his Dalai Lama. And we were able to spend time at Chöptön Sholin Monastery and at Shiwong in the presence of Rinpoche. And it's difficult for those of us in the West for whom a meeting with the Dalai Lama has become almost pro forma to realize that for tens of millions of people in Tibet and Central Asia, to be in the presence of one of these remarkable bodhisattvas would be a dream of a lifetime. And with Sherab and Mathieu and Rinpoche, we attended the Mani Rimdu ceremony at Shiwang Monastery, where through this extraordinary kind of dance, theater in the round, mythological recounting of tales, the arrival of Guru Rinpoche, the arrival of Buddhism in Tibet, is remembered once each year. And from the solemnity of Shiwang, we then took Rinpoche by a Russian helicopter up to a sacred set of caves at Sengepu, the caves to which he had retreated when he fled the Chinese in 1959. It was during that isolated period of retreat for 2 years when he saw his own lama in the personification of a vulture sweeping over, crying for him to come up to the Copper Mountain Paradise. But Rinpoche refused to go, knowing as a bodhisattva that his work remained on this plane, on this earth. And while we were with Rinpoche, suddenly walking around, and this I had been with him a great deal by this point, he suddenly astonished us all by sitting down suddenly on the ground and giving us darshan on the Four Noble Truths. And for those of you who don't know the Buddhist tradition, that would be a little bit like being a tourist in St. Peter's, bumping into the Pope, and suddenly being given a catechism. And it was the only time that I really came to understand the essence of this religion that so horrified the Chinese that they insisted upon murdering the people who professed to believe in it. And what are the Four Noble Truths? It's the essence of simplicity. All life is suffering. That doesn't mean that life is nihilistic or negative. It just means that terrible things happen. We grow old. We die on the eve of our weddings. Our children are suddenly afflicted by unexpected disease. This is just the nature of life. The source of all suffering, the Buddha said, was ignorance. And by ignorance, he did not mean stupidity. He meant the tendency of human beings to cling to the illusion that life is permanent, static, when everybody knows in their heart that it is impermanent, ever-changing. And he said in the third noble truth that ignorance vitally can be overcome. And in a way, the most important of all the Four Noble Truths is a final one, which delineated a path of contemplative practice which, if followed, would lead to the liberation, the end of ignorance, the end of all sources of ignorance, and the arrival into a state of transformation of the spirit, which would allow one to leave the realm of samsara and enter the realm of nirvana. And, of course, the simplicity of this, but the empirical evidence of the efficacy of the practice is indeed, through the eyes of the Tibetans, seen to be the serenity with which those who follow the practice live. And having had that incredible teaching from this remarkable lama, Mathieu and Sherab then embarked on foot on our own pilgrimage to a remote nunnery at the base of Mount Everest, where Sherab and Mathieu knew of a remarkable woman, Setsun Ani, a wonderful woman who had taken the vows of isolation, and she had lived in a small cube of a room in a shadowy darkness for 45 years. She had never opened the door to an outsider, with the exception of Sherab, who had been treating her medically. And I was wondering, as we walked toward Everest, what kind of human being would I meet? What creature would open that door? And this is a photograph, the only photograph taken of her, showing the moment when she opened the door after 45 years in total isolation. And you would have expected from our Western ideas to find a madwoman. On the contrary, you never met someone who is more clear, more in their place, more confident in the path they had chosen. And as she said to Mathieu, forget all the Baroque stuff you do in those monasteries. All you must do is chant the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And for 45 years, her life had been all about that, giving the rewards of her blessings to all sentient beings. The true bodhisattva, the true Buddhist hero, not the individual who conquers the top of a mountain, but the individual who prays in this realm for the well-being of all sentient beings. And that really is a power of the Tibetan faith, and that is why the Tibetan faith will overcome. Because in the end, the people will continue to pursue the breath of the Dharma. So in the end, we really have a choice. You know, what kind of world do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a monochromatic world of monotony, or do we want to celebrate a polychromatic world of diversity? Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist, said before she died that her greatest fear was that as we drifted toward a blandly amorphous kind of generic world, not only would the entire range of the human imagination be reduced to a more narrow modality of thought, but that we'd wake one day as from a dream, having forgotten that there were other possibilities for life. You know, the human species has been around for over 100,000 years. If the Neolithic Revolution was 10,000 years ago, modern industrial society as we know it is scarcely 300 years old. And that shallow history shouldn't suggest to any of us that we have all of the answers for all of the challenges that will confront us as a species in the ensuing millennia. The other myriad peoples of the world are not failed attempts at being us. They are, to the contrary, unique and wondrous manifestations of the human spirit, unique answers to the fundamental question, what does it mean to be human and alive? And when asked that question, they respond with 6,000 different voices. And it's within that diversity of the spirit, that body of hope, that we can find the opportunity to be what we always know we can be, a fully conscious species, fully capable of ensuring that all peoples in every garden have a way to flourish. The goal, of course, is not to freeze people in time like some kind of zoological specimen. Nobody could if they wanted to, and no one would want to do that. The goal is to find a way to create truly multicultural, pluralistic societies wherein all peoples of the world can have benefits of the genius of modernity without that engagement having to demand the death of their ethnicity. Because if there's one thing that anthropology teaches, it's that culture is not trivial. Culture is not decorative, it's not feathers and bells. Culture is a blanket of moral and ethical values that we insulate the individual with to keep the barbaric heart that history teaches us lies just beneath the surface of the living at bay. It is culture that allows us to make sense out of sensation. It is culture that allows us to find order and meaning in a universe that may have none. It is culture that allows us, as Lincoln said, always to reach for the better angels of our nature. And if you want to know what happens when culture is lost, when tradition is stripped from the individual and the individual is cast into an uncertain future with no foundations to the past, no certainty of achieving anything but a place in the lowest rung of an economic ladder that goes nowhere, you simply have to look at Mogadishu, Liberia, the Shining Path, the Maoists at the streets of Kathmandu, the fury and horror of Al-Qaeda, to realize that civilization and culture is indeed a thin veneer that must be protected for the sake of all of us. Now, there are wonderful moments of hope in this story, not the least of which would be found in our own homeland of Canada in the creation of Nunavut. You know, the Canadian government and the British were not obviously always kind to the Inuit people. In fact, when the Inuit first reached their encounter with the British explorers in the 19th century, they took the British to be gods. The British took the Inuit to be savages. Both were wrong, but one did more to honor the human race. What the British failed to understand was that there was no better measure of genius than the ability to survive in that harsh Arctic landscape on a technology that was limited to what you could carve from bone and stone and small bits of wood that floated up from the sea. The Inuit didn't fear the cold, they took advantage of it. The runners of their sleds were originally made of fish, Arctic char, laid in the row and wrapped in reindeer skin or caribou skin. This man, Olaiac, told me a marvelous story when I went narwhal hunting with him at the tip of Baffin Island. And during the time of the 50s, when the Canadian government attempted to forcibly move the Inuit into settlements, this man's grandfather categorically refused to go. The family, fearful for his life, took away all of his tools and all of his weapons, hoping that that would force him into the settlement. Did it? No. In the middle of an Arctic night with a blizzard blowing, the old man slipped outside of the igloo, pulled down his caribou hide trousers, and defecated into his hand. As the feces froze, he shaped the human waste into the form of a blade. And as the shit knife took final form because of the cold, he put a spray of saliva along one edge to make a sharpened edge, and with that implement, he killed a dog. He skinned the dog with it and improvised traces of a sled with the skin of the dead dog, and improvised a sled with the rib cage of the dead dog, harnessed up an adjacent living dog, and then shit knife and belt disappeared into the night. Now, talk about getting by with nothing. And that kind of amazing dexterity of mind and intellect is something that people see amongst Inuit people all over the circumpolar region. And of course, these are a people for whom blood on ice is not a sign of death, it's an affirmation of life itself. A people who, through the nature of the hunt, because these are not hunting and gathering societies, these are hunting societies, people who have formed a relationship with the wildlife that allows them to maintain what can only be described as an open dialogue, both on this plane and in the realm of the myth. And I recently went to the Iglulik on the Melville Peninsula and went out in the Furry and Hecla Strait, 200 kilometers, to go polar bear hunting with a community members from Iglulik. It was an extraordinary opportunity. It was very cold this day, minus 55 with a 30-mile-an-hour wind chill. But in the course of that hunt, I was able to really observe the way Inuit people interact in this extraordinary gesture, which is the prayer, which is the killing of the prey. And indeed, this is something that those of us from non-hunting societies always forget, that even the mythology of the Inuit people or of any hunting people emerged as a kind of covenant between predator and prey and a way of these individuals rationalizing the fact that to live, they had to kill the thing they loved most, the animals upon which they depended. When we got back with the polar bear meat, it was cut up for distribution to all the elders of the community of Iglulik, and suddenly this young woman swept in and began to grab meat and take it away, eating it as she left. And I was curious about what it seemed to be a breach of protocol until I realized that this young woman had been given the name of the father of the hunter, thus she had become the father of the hunter who was now deceased, and even though the hunter, of course, was older than she had automatic right to the product of his labor. And then we flew from Iglulik across Ellesmere Island to the tip of Greenland to live with the polar Eskimo in the community of Kanak. And again, we went on the ice to hunt a bearded seal and walrus, accompanied my dear friend Gretel Ehrlich. And here's a perfect example of an indigenous people. You know, the issue isn't the traditional versus the modern. It's the right of a free people to choose the components of their lives. Here are the people, unlike the Inuit of the High Arctic of Canada, have refused to use skidoos. The only people still hunting both with kayak and with dog teams in the circumpolar area. And yet, having made this incredible gesture to maintain the elements of their lives by their own choosing, now the great tragedy throughout both communities of Iglulik and Kanak are the fact that something far beyond their control has now threatened their existence. And this, of course, is global climate change. It was astonishing to see the faces of the people when we would witness these open leads of water. You know, the ice in Kanak used to come in September and stay until July. Now it comes in November and stays until March. The entire season of the hunt has been cut in half. Robins are turning up in Iglulik, and suddenly you can see that indeed the Arctic and the Inuit people have emerged as sort of the canaries in the coal mine on this entire issue of global climate change. And the tragedy is, after everything that has happened up there, just as with the extraordinary creation of Nunavut and the celebration of life and the preservation of culture that is exemplified by the people of Kanak in northwest Greenland, just when all that is coming together, now this force beyond their control threatens their very existence. So in the end, we really have to ask a question, finally. You know, what kind of world do we want to live in? And I would argue that in the end, we need the prayers and the hopes and the dreams of these young Penan kids in this marvelous photograph taken by Tom Henley, or we need the prayers and dreams of these young Tibetan monks. Just as I, as a father, need the hopes and dreams of my own daughters. Here, my youngest playing football in Fiji last summer, or Tara photographed in Trobriand Islands later in that same month. Because for all of us, and for all time, these peoples and these places stand apart as symbols of the naked geography of hope. Thank you very much.